listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
U.S. President Donald Trump hosted Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari at the White House on Monday. After Trump welcomed President Buhari to Washington, the two held a press conference.
The United States is currently working to expand trade and commercial ties with African nations, including Nigeria, to create jobs and wealth in all of our countries. We hope to be the economic partner of choice for nations across the continent and all around the world. And you see what's happening with respect to trade and the United States. We are being respected again. I hope all African countries and countries throughout the world that we also will be supporting you and that they will likewise support us in our bid, along with Canada and Mexico, for the 2026 World Cup. We will be watching very closely, and any help that they could give us in that bid, we would appreciate. I'm pleased that Nigeria is one of our largest trading partners in the region. And we look forward to growing our trade relationship based on the principle of fairness and reciprocity. But we give Nigeria well over $1 billion in aid every year. And we have already started talking with the president about taking down the trade barriers, very substantial barriers to the United States trading with Nigeria. So we think that we are owed that. President Buhari has also taken several steps to fight corruption and improve the Nigerian business climate. And most of all to me, and again, is ripping down those trade barriers. These measures will make it easier for Nigeria and the United States companies to invest. And we will be investing substantially in Nigeria if they can create that level playing field that we have to very much ask for. and maybe demand. I especially want to thank President Buhari for Nigeria's partnership and leadership in the fight against terrorism. He's been a real leader. Nigeria was one of the first African nations to join the coalition to defeat ISIS. And Nigerian forces are currently leading regional efforts against ISIS in West Africa and doing very well, as we have. Nigeria is also leading African nations in the fight against Boko Haram and another ruthless jihadist terrorist group. You've been reading about them. They kidnap the young girls and young women, many of whom never are seen again. It's tough stuff. This summer was my honor to meet with two brave young women, Joy Bishara and Lydia Pogu, who were kidnapped by Boko Haram in April of 2014 at the secondary school in Nigeria. I was deeply moved by their inspiring stories of courage, resilience, and survival. They really were two amazing young women. I told Joy and Lydia, my administration is committed to combating both jihadist terrorism and the scourge of human trafficking and smuggling. In the world today, there is more human trafficking than there has ever been, if you can believe this. They use the internet better than almost anybody is able to use the internet. So think of it, in a modern world, in this world, there's more human trafficking and slavery than at any time in the history of this world. It's hard to believe. To protect Americans from these menaces, I have called on Congress to close deadly immigration loopholes that are exploited by terrorists, traffickers, and criminals. Just look at our southern border and our weak and obsolete immigration laws. They are obsolete and they are weak and they are pathetic. And there's no country in the world that has laws like we do. They've got to change, and they've got to change now for the safety of our country. We're also helping our Nigerian partners by facilitating intelligence, cooperation, and providing training and military equipment to Nigerian forces. For example, we recently sold Nigeria 12 U.S. A-29 Super Katano aircraft. It's a great aircraft. In the first ever sale of American military equipment to Nigeria, these new aircraft will improve Nigeria's ability to target terrorists and protect civilians. Finally, we're deeply concerned by religious violence in Nigeria, including the burning of churches and the killing and persecution of Christians. It's a horrible story. We encourage Nigeria and the federal, state, and local leaders to do everything in their power to immediately secure the affected communities and to protect innocent civilians of all faiths, including Muslims and including Christians. Mr. President, thank you again for visiting the White House and being with us today. Nigeria is a valued partner and a good friend. I look forward to working closely with you to deepen our cooperation and forge an even closer partnership. The United States is committed to working alongside Nigeria as we seek a future of strength, prosperity, and peace for both of our countries. Mr. President, thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. President of the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen of the media, it has been a pleasure and honor to visit Washington, D.C. at the kind invitation of President Donald Trump. Nigeria and the United States share a long history of close and cordial relations which encompass political, economic, military, social, and cultural cooperation. Our two countries maintain a strategic partnership for peace and security, conflict resolution, as well as the global fight against terrorism. We also share common features as secular federal states practicing a similar democratic model of governance and committed to the universal values of fundamental human rights and freedoms, free enterprise, social justice, and the rule of law. President Trump and his team and myself and the Nigerian team discussed issues related to security, trade, governance, human rights, and humanitarian crisis. We congratulated the leaders of the North and South Korea on their historic summit, and we applaud them for the positive commitment they have made towards denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. President Trump deserves a great deal of credit for his statesmanly role in transforming so dramatically the course of events in that region. We also congratulated the United States government on the important role it played in the defeat of ISIS, although some of the remnants have found their way to the Sahel region. We recognize the strong United States support in our fight against terrorism and also appreciated very much the United States agreement to sell 12 Super Tucano A-29 warplanes and weapons to Nigeria to effectively fight terrorism. To contain the spread of insurgency in Nigeria, the federal government has adopted a multi-sectorial approach involving related government agencies to address the socio-economic and political dimensions, while the armed forces of Nigeria assist the civil authority to provide security and maintain law and order. As part of efforts to address emerging cases of insurgency in the country, the Nigerian military adopted counter-terrorism insurgency approach codenamed Operation Safe Corridor to de-radicalize, rehabilitate, and reintegrate willingly surrendered Boko Haram members into the larger society. This program is currently embarking on a number of projects, including skill acquisition centers and integrated farms comprising poultry, fish pond, and greenhouse farming, among others. A number of international partners, including the International Organization for Migration, have contributed to the success of Operation Safe Corridor. We indicated that we would appreciate whatever support we could also get from the United States. We express gratitude to the United States support in the reconstruction and rehabilitation efforts in the northeast of Nigeria, as well as humanitarian assistance to the internally displaced persons through agencies such as the United States Agency for International Development and other international partners. The United States of America has been, to date, the biggest contributor to the humanitarian response, and last year gave approximately $500 million United States dollars in cash and in kind contribution through the United Nations and other intergovernmental organizations. These have mainly supported protection activities, health, food assistance, and shelter. We are doing all we can to secure the release of the remaining abducted school girls from Defchi and Chibok. In this context, we will continue to welcome United States collaboration in intelligence gathering, hostage negotiations, and information sharing. The government is taking necessary steps to promote the peaceful coexistence of herdsmen and farmers by focusing on boosting security and enforcing legislation that will guarantee borders and farmers access to land. I extend sincere congratulations to President Trump and his government on the impressive performance of the United States economy under his watch. Our aim is to diversify our own economy by focusing on agriculture and food security, power and infrastructure. We have cut the importation of rice by 90%, thereby saving a significant amount of money. We very much welcome increased United States investment in Nigerian economy, especially the non-oil sector. Economic relations between Nigeria and the United States are anchored on three major instruments, namely the Binational Commission, Trade and Investment Framework Agreement, and the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. The Binational Commission in particular, comprising bilateral, political, economic, developmental, and humanitarian partnership, is a basic economic framework for engagement between our two countries. Nigeria's trade volume with the United States stood at $6.07 billion, according to 2016 statistics, and comprised $4.76 billion worth of Nigerian export to the United States, and $1.894 billion exports to Nigeria. We urge greater effort to increase these figures substantially. We thank the United States government very much for cooperation we have received in our effort to recover stolen funds. Our two governments have put the machinery in place for their respective attorney generals to collaborate in ensuring the return to Nigeria of over $500 million of looted funds siphoned away in banks around the world. In this connection, we congratulate the United States government on launching a Leptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative, which was spearheaded by the United States Department of Justice Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering. We hoped that we could continue to count on United States support in this area. The government of Nigeria remains deeply committed to the principles of human rights, as well as promotion and protection of people's freedom, even in the process of fighting terror. We commit to ensure that all documented cases of human rights abuses are investigated and those responsible for violation held responsible. I thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Steve Miller of the Washington Times, please. Washington Times. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. President. Got a two-parter on immigration. Last week, in the Supreme Court case over your travel ban, the lawyers for the opponents said that if you would simply apologize for some of your rhetoric during the campaign, the whole case would go away. And I was wondering if you would
be willing.
I don't
think it would, number one. And there's no reason to apologize. Our immigration laws in this country are a total disaster. They're laughed at all over the world. They're laughed at for their stupidity. And we have to have strong immigration laws. So I think if I apologize, it wouldn't make 10 cents worth of difference to them. There's nothing to apologize for. We have to have strong immigration laws to protect our country.
And looking to the future, the caravan has arrived at the U.S. border.
We've been watching it. We've been watching it.
And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, or your estimation, what percentage of those people do you believe are deserving of asylum in the U.S.?
Well, I won't get into percentages, but we are a nation of laws. We have to have borders. We don't have borders, we don't have a country. And I've been watching for weeks as the caravan came up. And you know, the Mexican laws are very tough on immigration, extremely tough. And it started out with way over 1,000 people. I guess now it's down to about 100 going all through Mexico. People don't realize what a big country Mexico is, but it came down by a lot. And now we're working on the border with the worst laws any country, no matter where you go, all over the world. They can't even believe it. And we're doing the best we can with it. But we have to have changes in Congress. And we have to have it quickly. We need a wall, number one. And you see that right now, you know, where they are.
even though it's not a particularly good wall, and even though a small percentage can climb to the top, they have to be in extremely good shape. But a small percentage can climb that particular wall. We have a wall that's much more difficult. But if you didn't have that, you'd have thousands of people just pouring into our country. You got to have a wall. And we need border security. And we will have border security. As you know, we're sending many, many National Guardsmen down to the border. Most of them are already there. And that's having a big impact. But we need a change in the law. Catch and release is ridiculous. If they touch our property, if they touch our country, essentially you catch them and you release them into our country. That's not acceptable to anybody. So we need a change in the law.
Mr. President, when you were sitting down in the Oval Office with President Trump, who ran on not wanting to be the policeman for the world, what kind of arguments did you make to convince him to continue a military presence for the U.S. in your country? And what arguments did you make to him? How receptive was he?
I can't understand what you mean by United States presence in my country. They sent a training team based on their experiences to train our officers at some of our training institutions and move to the crisis area to see how those they train are performing. I think this is one of the best things the United States could do for us to stabilize the country.
And he agreed with that?
I do, very much so. That's why I thank him for it.
Thank you.
Well, we more and more are, because it's a very fair question, we more and more are not wanting to be the policemen of the world. And we're spending tremendous amounts of money for decades on policing the world, and that shouldn't be our priority. We want to police ourselves, and we want to rebuild our country. And the president understands that. They've come a long way. They're doing a great job. We're contributing to that job, but they have done a great job. What we do want to do, though, is open Nigeria and other countries up to trade, because we have spent over the last decade a number that's so large you wouldn't even believe it. And I think we'll be treated in a reciprocal fashion now as of today. So I think that's going to happen. And I have great respect for the president. Okay. How about Jordan Fabian? Where's Jordan? Jordan, the Hill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I want to ask you about Iran. The Israeli Prime Minister just gave a speech very critical of their nuclear program. I want to ask if you have made up your mind to pull out of that deal. And if you do pull out of that deal, do you think, are you worried that it sends the wrong message to North Korea as you seek to enter nuclear talks with Kim Jong-un?
No, I think it sends the right message. You know, in 7 years, that deal will have expired and Iran is free to go ahead and create nuclear weapons. That's not acceptable. 7 years is tomorrow. That's not acceptable. So, no, if anything, it's proven right what Israel has done today with the news conference. And Prime Minister Netanyahu just gave a very, I don't know if everybody's seen it, but I got to see a little bit of it. And that is just not an acceptable situation. And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but a lot of people think they know. And on or before the 12th, we'll make a decision. That doesn't mean we won't negotiate a real agreement. You know, this is an agreement that wasn't approved by too many people. And it's a horrible agreement for the United States, including the fact, Mr. President, that we gave Iran $150 billion and $1.8 billion in cash. Nigeria would like some of that. $1.8 billion in cash and $150 billion. You know what we got? We got nothing. We got nothing. So that doesn't mean I wouldn't negotiate a new agreement. We'll see what happens. But I think, if anything, what's happening today and what's happened over the last little while and what we've learned has really shown that I've been 100% right.
And President Buhari, I want to ask you, you're the first leader from sub-Saharan Africa to visit President Trump here at the White House. Did you address his reported comments from earlier this year when he reportedly used vulgar language to describe African nations?
Well, I'm very careful with what the press says about others and myself. I'm not sure about the validity or whether that allegation against the president was true or not. So the best thing for me is to keep quiet.
We didn't discuss it. And you do have some countries that are in very bad shape and very tough places to live in. But we didn't discuss it because the president knows me and he knows where I'm coming from. And I appreciate that. We did not discuss it. Mr. President, you can ask a question.
Yes, that lady is already up. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Juliana. Mr. President Trump, I would like to know, Nigeria is in dire need of the Tucano aircraft to tackle the problem back home. Will you be kind enough to release at least two before 2020 to enable the country tackle the situation in the country? And how soon will you be visiting Nigeria?
Well, I would like to visit Nigeria. I'd like very much to visit Nigeria. It's an amazing country, and in certain ways, I hear from the standpoint of the beauty of a country, there's no country more beautiful. So I would like to. And the first part of your question, I couldn't hear what you were saying. Go ahead.
The helicopters.
Oh, helicopters.
Yes.
Oh, we love helicopters. He likes them more than I do. He likes buying helicopters, but he is, and they're buying a lot of helicopters. Helicopters.
We want to know how soon
we're
releasing them to the country.
Yes, very soon. We're getting it approved. Part of the problem was that you weren't allowed to buy helicopters in our country, and now you are. I worked that out so that now you can buy the helicopters that you want. They weren't allowed to buy the helicopters in our country for various reasons, which, frankly, were not good reasons. But now they get them, and they get them very quickly, and they are the best helicopters anywhere in the world. We make the best military equipment in the world, and our friends can now buy that equipment. Mr. President?
Thank you very much.
Did you have a question for the president?
President Trump, my question is to President Trump.
Thank you.
The fight against corruption is one of the major achievements that the Nigerian government has presented to the world. And the records show that the United States of America is one of the major destination countries of illicit funds and assets from Nigeria. To what extent did you discuss the need to repatriate these funds back to Nigeria to fund critical infrastructure, to cut down funding for terrorism, and also to reduce illegal immigration from Nigeria to your country?
Yes, we have actually discussed all of those topics at length over the last period of time. And in terms of corruption, Nigeria has a reputation, as you understand very well, for very massive corruption. I also know that the president has been able to cut that down very substantially. We talked about it. He is working on it, and they have made a lot of progress, and I think they will continue to make a lot of progress. We have a lot of people in this country and, frankly, the country itself that invests in Nigeria. So cutting down on that corruption element and a corrupt element is very important to us. And the president will be able to do that.
President? To President Buhari. The United States import of crude oil from Nigeria has considerably gone down. Did you discuss the need for the U.S. to increase its import of crude oil from Nigeria?
No, I can't tell the United States what to do. But luckily for us, we have got market for our crude oil elsewhere. But progress made by United States in technology is certainly frightening for us that are a mono economy. I hope technology will allow them to use our crude for its quality for petrochemicals, be it light one vis-a-vis the one they are getting from shale. Thank you.
I think maybe more than anything else, what we discussed today was our agricultural products going into Nigeria, which Nigeria wants, but we have certain barriers that don't allow that to happen. So for the good of our farmers, U.S. farmers, and for the good of Nigeria and all of Africa, it's very important that we are able to sell our great agricultural products into Nigeria, and that will happen, and we're going to be working on that right away. Okay? Thank you all very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Will you be, give it to DMZ, sir?
It's possible. It's very possible.
Well, it was an interesting thought, and I had that thought. We're looking at various countries, including Singapore, and we are also talking about the possibility of the DMZ, Peace House, Freedom House. And there's something that I thought was intriguing. I think that some people maybe don't like the look of that, and some people like it very much. I threw it out today as an idea. I also told President Moon, and through President Moon, we connected with North Korea. There's something that I like about it because you're there. You're actually there, where if things work out, there's a great celebration to be had on the site, not in a third-party country. So we are looking at the possibility of doing it in that location. We're also looking at various other countries, including Singapore. I will say this, the good news, everybody wants us. It has the chance to be a big event. And the United States, I was talking to John Bolton about this a little while ago, the United States has never been closer to potentially having something happen with respect to the Korean Peninsula that can get rid of the nuclear weapons, can create so many good things, so many positive things, and peace and safety for the world. So we'll see what happens. You know, I often say, who knows? Who knows? Maybe a lot of things change. But Kim Jong-un, who has been very open and very straightforward so far, I can only say again, so far, but he's talking about getting rid of the site, which was their big site. He's talking about no research, no launching of ballistic missiles, no nuclear testing. And he has lived up to that for a long period of time, longer period of time than anybody has seen. So we are looking at that as a potential site. Yes, I think it would be very interesting. I think it would be a great celebration if it works out well. And if it doesn't work out well, that's the way it goes. I think the summit will happen. And personally, I think it's going to be a success, but we'll see. I will say this. Got to get rid of the nuclear weapons. If it's not a success, I will respectfully leave. It's very simple. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Worlds Apart. After receiving a Nobel Peace Prize just a few years ago, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons now finds itself at the center of a major military standoff, which some fear may digress into World War III. Can this obscure scientific organization, tasked with upholding a major international norm, do its job without itself falling victim to geopolitical wrangling? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Anton Utkin, a former UN chemical weapons expert in Iraq. Dr. Utkin, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming over this morning.
Hello.
Now, just a few years ago, very few people apart from a narrow circle of specialists even knew what the OPCW was. It only started to appear in global media after famous or infamous Barack Obama's statement on the red line. If it weren't for that statement, do you think we would be discussing the use of chemical weapons today?
Well, the point is that right now we see that the special position of Western countries assigning the responsibility for the use of chemical weapons to Iraqi government, Syrian government, makes it possible for the all opposition groups to use the chemical weapon to pretend that this is the fault of Syrian government. Because in a situation like today, the Western countries, they do not wait for any investigation. They assign the responsibility, and then they punish for the chemical weapon use.
But when you say they punish, both in this case with the latest strikes and in the previous case with the alleged attack on Han Shih-un. The response by the United States, by its allies, was definitely illegal from the point of view of international law, but it was also very limited. And it's also quite difficult to understand what kind of military objective it could have pursued. Do you think the point of using these chemical weapons you scare, is the point political or is it military? Is it to advance a military objectives or simply to, you know, malign Syria even more?
No, we do not see any real military gains by doing these strikes. So this is really a political issue. If this would be technical or military or something, then it would require a little bit more than just accusations based on videos from the internet or social network.
But what's the point then? Clearly, they don't like President Assad. I mean, they made that position clear 7 years ago. So what's the point of pushing this red line that they supposedly want to protect themselves? I mean, it's clear to understand from a tactical and strategic point of view what could be gained from that.
Well, of course, delegitimizing the Syrian government is an important issue. Right now, we see that the Syrian government, with the support of Russians and the Iranians, they are gaining more control of the Syrian territory that was under the Islamic State control previously. And, of course, all the actors in this area, they understand that the winner will get everything. And they would like to get their foot in the door to make sure that they still would be viable players in
but
that
from
area.
What I understood, Russia, Iran, Turkey did try to engage them in various negotiating formats. It's not like, I mean, there is a talk about having a government of national reconciliation in Syria. There is a talk about holding new elections. So there are some political venues that they can pursue. And to the credit of both the Russians and the Syrians, I'm an interested party here, but still, I think they allowed many of the militant groups to leave the area, which is, by my account, unprecedented in the modern history of warfare. So these people are actually treated pretty decently, aren't they?
Well, yes, but you have to understand that when Russians and Syrians allow a certain bunches of opposition to leave the certain areas, you have to understand that these are not just oppositions. According to Syrian sources, there was about 700 Western advisors together with that opposition. And of course, when they were finishing, the opposition at that area, so that would be risks that some Western advisors also could be hit.
From the intensity of allegations, I think perhaps the goals that they are pursuing are far bigger. Delegitimization not only the Syrian government. I mean, in that point of view, it's not legitimate at all. But do you think their goals go farther in terms of delegitimizing both Russia, Iran, and perhaps even Turkey?
You can see that. It's a chain of events. After Russia vetoed the joint investigative mechanism, we got a sudden statement of Nikki Haley, who said that Russia bears responsibility for the use of chemical weapons in Syria. That was kind of shocking.
Oh, but I mean, there were similar statements to that effect before.
Wait a second. She never did that in that
Well, she
context.
Never did that, but her predecessor at the United Nations certainly blamed Russia for a very high civilian death toll.
They were blaming Russia for supporting Assad, who used the chemical weapons. But the direct blaming Russia for the use of chemical weapons in Syria, that was very strange. Also very shocking, because Russia had very, very, very high reputation in the world of chemical weapons.
Let me ask you specifically about the role that the OPCW can play in all of that, because unlike national governments, unlike national delegations, it is actually constrained by its own convention. It has to follow the procedure, or at least be seen as following the procedure.
How much does that allow for political influences to be exerted on the scientists?
That's a very good question. Well, the OPCW was invented as an organization that would be purely technical. But the structure of OPCW allows some politics. So the OPCW consists of a conference of state parties. It's 192 countries. Then Executive Council and the Technical Secretariat. There are people who do the technical work. So inspectors, interpreters, technical assistants, and so on.
Administration.
But they do the real work. Executive Council consists of 41 state parties. And that's exactly the area where politics could be brought. The last events, especially the situation in Salisbury and the situation in the use of chemical weapons in Syria, brought more politics in the situation.
Now, the difference from my point of view between politics and science is that politics starts with a conclusion and science is supposed to be open-ended. When you go out to investigate something, you should not have any preconceived notion about who might have done it. How does it balance itself out when it comes to the actual investigation? So, for example, when scientists go out and collect the samples, do they have enough freedom to investigate those samples and to deliver the scientific opinion on them?
Yeah, very good question. But let me show how the politics differ from the technical issues. When Russia suggested a decision of Executive Council to support the mission of OPCW in Syria, the Western countries actually blocked that decision. But Syria wrote the request to OPCW to send a mission of inspectors to Duma, and OPCW did that. So this is politics versus technical. So how technically this work is performed? The inspectors come to the area of alleged use of chemical weapons, and they collect samples. But aside that, they also work with the people. They work with hospitals. They talk with witnesses. They see those people who were admitted in hospitals and take their biological samples. And all those samples, they are brought to the headquarters of OPCW in The Hague. And from The Hague, the samples are sent to the designated laboratories. There are 22 designated laboratories in the world at the moment. And they analyze those samples.
The OPCW did have probes into alleged use of chemical weapons in Syria before. And I talked last year to the Russian envoy, to the organization, Mr. Shulgin, and he told me that some of those probes were staffed by the people, by the specialists who tend to come from the Friends of Syria group. And that group obviously is very eager to see Mr. Assad out. Many of the samples and many of the testimonies were provided by Turkey, which is also not the neutral player in that war. So if how can you have so much confidence in the process right now when in the past it delivered the results that Russia clearly didn't agree with?
Yeah, that is a very good question. But look, you can trust to the results of designated laboratories only in the case when the samples are taken according to the chain of custody. And that means that an inspector of OPCW came to the site, took the sample himself, put it in a vial, and not just closed it, but sealed it with a special seal that cannot be broken. And then those samples are delivered to the designated laboratories. They're opened in controlled environments. All the records are kept that this is exactly that sample, and they are analyzed.
Okay, we now already have I think, a very clear effort in the Western media to suggest that Russia and Syria use this initial delay in the ability of the OPCW inspectors to access the scene, that they used it specifically to clean the area. From a technical, from a scientific point of view, can the OPCW inspectors establish whether the scene was tampered with? Because even if they deliver clean samples in this case, clean from the Russian point of view, the West, I think, would easily come out and say that, well, there is nothing there simply because the Russians killed all the evidence.
Well, yes, but in the case of Han Chih-hun, actually, there were not the OPCW inspectors who came and took the samples.
Yeah, it's the Turkish side that provided them with lots of inconsistencies,
yes,
and contradictions.
But it didn't prevent the JIM, Joint Investigative Mechanism, to state that even 10 days after the use of chemical weapons in Han Chih-hun, it was possible to analyze the samples and determine that that was a chemical agent in there.
So you think that Russia can rely on that kind of argument this time?
Not
around?
Really. But the point is, theoretically, yes, you can clean the area. But if that was the use of chemical weapons, and remember, chemical weapons is not the one you take a poison and inject it into one person. So you have to contaminate a whole area to make the mass killing of people. So that's chemical weapon. If you did that, so it's the whole area should be contaminated. Soil, building constructions, and
clothes,
a lot of area in structures. And to clean it, really clean it, you have to probably demolish maybe a couple of blocks. Not even block a couple, but maybe 5-10 blocks of the city you have to demolish and take it out. So it's impossible to do that. But it's not just samples. This is witnesses. This is hospitals. This is victims.
But you know, there is a narrative, a Western narrative for that too, and we already seen that in the Western papers, suggesting that some of the witnesses have been under pressure from the Assad government. Anyway, Dr. Utkin, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to World Apart with Anton Utkin, a former UN chemical weapons expert in Iraq. Dr. Utkin, the Syrian file is obviously not the only one that the OPCW is wrestling with. The Skripal case is still going through the motions at the organization. In terms of the procedural options open to them, is it looking better for Russia or the UK at this point?
The longer the UK officials keep the results of investigation in secret, so the more capability they have to blame Russia without any supporting evidences. The question is why this happens. The point is, first, we see that right now the UK generated over 17 different versions of how Skripals were poisoned. We see how they determine where the chemical was produced.
Yeah, they also lied about the country of origin, but they still continue doing that. And I think correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that if there's any hope for Russia to sort of constrain that, it would be through using the OPCW mechanism. Now, my understanding, and I may be wrong on that, is that the UK from the very beginning wanted to create an impression of the OPCW being involved, but it did not follow the formal route. It went through the technical secretariat rather than through the formal procedure prescribed by the convention. Why would they do that, and why would the OPCW agree to be engaged in such an unconventional way through the technical secretariat rather than through, you know, challenge inspections and what have you?
Well, step by step. First of all, why the United Kingdom started to bring the politics to the walls of OPCW? First of all, you have to understand that actually killing one person is a criminal case. So it's not the use of chemical weapons, like the brother of...
But if it's a military-grade nerve agent, I would assume on a foreign territory...
The brother of Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, was killed with VX. That was military-grade agent. Novichok was never proved to be a chemical-grade agent. And if you take the scientific board of OPCW, who considered Novichok issue in 2011, they said there is no confirmation that this is chemical, military-grade agent.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think it was in the interest of the UK to engage the OPCW at
see,
all?
Then you can blame, not just in the criminal case, but you can blame the perpetrators in the use of chemical weapons, which is much more aggravated accusation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And actually, this is wrong, because the brother of Kim Jong-un was killed with VX, but nobody used OPCW in this case. So, right now, they started to use OPCW, but they didn't call for the inspection to inspect the alleged use of chemical weapon. They invited OPCW inspection, even not inspection, but representatives as a technical assistance. And the only question that they put before OPCW people was, if the chemical that we determined to be used as a poison is correct or not. So OPCW people collected samples, they checked it and said, yes, this is correct structure of the chemical. Mm-hmm. And that was it. But that allowed the UK to state that OPCW confirmed their suspicions against Russia, which was absolutely
wrong. Well, they were already called out on that. But I saw you say in a previous interview that it was a mistake on the part of Russia not to pursue Article 9 of the Convention in a more forceful way. Do you think Russia still has the procedural means to pressure the UK to provide all the evidence that it has? Because my understanding of why they didn't pursue the formal route is because they would have had to provide all the, you know, intelligence information, all the classified data in order to call for, let's say, a challenge inspection. By using the technical secretary, they don't really have to provide anything. Is that right?
Well, according to the Article 9, there is a procedure that you can request the state party, and you can exchange information and consult with the state party. If you do not have a satisfactory answer, you can go through the Executive Council. And if you do not get the satisfactory counsel, you can go up to the conference of state parties.
Do you think Russia should call for such counsel?
I believe that Russia right now is going according to the procedure. So it, Russia requested information from the UK. It didn't get the satisfied answer. So right now it's in position to make the same request from the Executive Council. And now Executive Council wouldn't vote for that. So they would just transfer that request to the UK, and UK will provide the answer already to Executive Council, which will be transferred to Russia then. So Russia has to use this procedure, and that would show that Russia follows the international law.
So it's ultimately about who weaponizes the bureaucracy better. Do I understand you correctly? Who pursues the bureaucracy,
well,
who uses
right
bureaucracy
now,
to...
Well, Russia follows all the procedures of the convention, unlike the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Now, in one of your previous interviews, you also said that this very categorical nature of Britain's accusations against Russia left it with no room for maneuver. Essentially, London has no other way but to double down on its initial narrative, regardless of how conflicting the evidence is. And I think that was perhaps a theme in our discussion on Syria. But, and I'm going to ask you again, do you think any amount of evidence, any amount of testimony, due process, following the rules, is going to help to settle this issue in a way that would be fair to all sides? Because from my position, from my point of view, what we have is a political wrangling yet again. Nobody is really interested, apart perhaps for Russia, in establishing the scientific facts.
That's exactly true. Russia really is interested in the joint investigation, and Russia pushes for it. Why? Anybody can say, well, this is this happened on UK territory. No, it happened with a Russian citizen. Russia, according to the Vienna Convention on Consulate Relations, has the right to communicate with the Russian citizen in any case, but the United Kingdom doesn't allow to do that. So now, even in the situation with the details of the investigation, I would like you to note one thing. Actually, recently, the general director of OPCW was interviewed by Pranks, and he said very interesting thing. That was the question: why Novichok agent was determined and decomposed only in the blood of Yulia Skripal? It was undecomposed. It's supposed to be decomposed under the metabolism of the
yeah,
body. But they found undecomposed agent in their blood, in her blood, but not in the blood of Sergei Skripal, who was exposed, got heavier exposure to the chemical agent. So, and that was very strange, because it is not clear how it happened that a fresh agent was in
Dr. Rutkin, it's not the first inconsistency in these or any previous investigations. I mean, the very nature of the allegation that Theresa May's government made against Russia, I mean, they are accusing us of lawful use of force by the Russian state against the United Kingdom. This is an unprecedented allegation. But when they made a decision to go ahead with it, I assume that they have also made a calculation that they have what it takes to win this battle of narrative. I suppose that they presume that they have enough friends, enough allies, enough political ammunition to get what they want.
Right. And the UK is winning some a part of this battle. But when I learned law in MBA, I was told that if you see a dead body and a person running with a knife around this body, it doesn't mean that that person
is
the killer.
You're trying to apply common sense or
yes.
law to this situation when I think it's no longer applicable. You yourself said that the Vienna Convention is nothing to the UK authorities. They couldn't care less about it.
Yes, true, but you have to understand that the world is not circling right now around the UK, US, and several more Western countries. A lot of countries are watching the situation, and they make a conclusion that actually any of them can undergo the same situation when they can be blamed in the use of chemical weapon, and they can be struck with missiles on that reason. And right now they see how Russia is performing in this situation, and they really have to understand who they are going to be for in this situation.
Well,
because tomorrow things can turn against them.
Let me ask you one more question about the questionable claims that the Russian side has advanced. I'm sure you heard the Russian foreign minister's statement about the Swiss lab's discovery of the BZ toxin in some samples, as well as speculations that the Skripal symptoms are more consistent with the BZ poisoning rather than Novichok's. Those claims were directly contradicted by the OPCW, which said it was discovered in control rather than the actual samples. Do you think the BZ story is closed by now? And do you think it was appropriate on the Russian side to present that information in the way it was presented?
Well, to be frank with you, I believe that the explanation of OPCW is quite satisfactory. Yeah, they can do special control samples to make sure that it is determined by both laboratories, and they know exactly what the.
But do you think the Russians were right to use the confidential information that they, I assume, received through some intelligence sources in such a way that would put the OPCW on the spot? Because Russia does need the goodwill and cooperation and neutrality of that international body. Wasn't that undermining that goodwill?
Well, right now Russia is in a situation when it's blamed without any evidence. So what should Russia do? Play the game when Russia is 100% loser from the beginning? Russia is supposed to use any case, any fact, any evidence to protect itself and to fight in this particular game.
What you're saying is that desperate times call for desperate measures. Dr. Utkin, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your being with us this morning, and I invite our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.